Truth Espresso, episode 15.
Face it, we all would rather sleep in this morning. That's why God gave us espresso, to kickstart our zombified corpses into hyperdrive. And now, giving your mind and soul the morning shot of truth it craves. This is Truth Espresso with Daniel Minnick.
Hello, this is Daniel Minnick, and welcome to another episode of Truth Espresso. In the last episode, we looked at John Irving's brief history lesson into the 1800s, or rather the lack thereof. John Irving is the author of a New York Times article entitled "The Long, Cruel History of the Anti-Abortion Crusade." This episode is a continuing series responding to this article by Mr. John Irving. And Mr. John Irving writes this article as someone who has written a lot of abortion fiction. He has written novels about abortion. One of them, called The Cider House Rules, was made into a movie. And so I thought that I would reply to this article by John Irving complaining about the so-called anti-abortion crusade, in which he attempts to give pro-lifers a history lesson about how history was friendlier toward abortion in the United States, and how that we need to return to that since abortion restrictions have become more prevalent, or at least in the mind of John Irving, more prevalent than they were in the past. So, in this series of episodes, we have put Mr. John Irving's apparent theory of a large doctor conspiracy to the test of logic and good common sense in the last episode. Admittedly, Mr. Irving is not alone in this theory. If you search for abortion history in the 1800s on your favorite internet search engine, such as Google, you will run into plenty of pro-abortion articles that make the same case. The conspiracy theory of abortion fiction does not seem to be original with abortion fiction writer John Irving. It is the fiction taught by pro-abortion lobbyists in the United States. So, what is the goal of this episode, as I intend to close this series of responding to John Irving's article? This episode, we will look at the actual history of anti-abortion law in the United States, and even in England, in the 1800s. When you strip your thinking of pro-abortion propaganda that avoids the actual issue of the debate and allow history to speak for itself, it makes a whole lot more sense than promoting a medical conspiracy theory about doctors that had to have said one thing but meant another. If you want more understanding of this cover-up by doctors that Mr. Irving presents, listen to the previous episode to understand this conspiracy theory more. Now, let's review some statements from Mr. John Irving in the article for the New York Times. These statements we went over in the last episode. So, first statement, quote, "But why did doctors lobby for abortion to be illegal? What was their logic? Did doctors underestimate how great the need for abortion was?" Unquote. And the word "need" is in italics in the original quote. Perhaps we can answer these questions by solving the doctor conspiracy theory with some actual history. If we want to answer the question why doctors lobbied against abortion, wouldn't it make more sense to read their actual words and follow their arguments? If we want to understand what their logic was, we should read their words. Did they underestimate how great the quote-unquote need was for abortion? Perhaps their words could tell us. Instead of assuming that they were dishonest, maybe we can actually read their words and assume that their words reflected their actual beliefs. You know, perhaps advances in science and medicine made the elephant in the room a little more clear for some people. Okay, the next quote from Mr. Irving in his article that we're going to review and respond to. Quote, "We don't know the doctor's reasons for making abortion illegal," unquote. Yes, because we can take Mr. Irving, the abortion fiction writer, as an authority over the thoughts and intents of the hearts of these doctors in the 19th century. We just don't know their reasons. We can't. How in the world can we know their reasons? Oh, I know, by reading what they wrote. Simple, huh? Continuing with Mr. Irving's article, quote, "In the 1840s, the fetus wasn't yet sacred. Fetal life was still defined by quickening, when the woman felt the fetus move, not before the fourth or fifth month," unquote. So, Mr. Irving, the fetus wasn't yet quote-unquote sacred? What about your life? Is it sacred? What about your closest family or friends, if you have any? Are their lives sacred? What is Mr. Irving's answer to the fetus being quote-unquote sacred? That magical, medical, and very objective and scientific concept of quickening. Of course, I'm being a little sarcastic there. Mr. Irving actually seems to make the argument that medical professionals should let so-called quickening rule the day and determine what is quote-unquote sacred and what is not sacred. Mr. Irving, you know as well as I do that quickening is not a medical phenomenon. You know that quickening is not a stage of punctuated equilibrium, as it were, in embryonic development. Then why are you even making this argument? You are trying to tell doctors who were making advances and discoveries in gynecology and surgery that they should ignore anything they actually observe and simply submit to an antiquated, superstitious concept that was born out of ignorance that advances in science revealed could not be a standard. In the last episode, we even quoted from an article written by an abortion advocate that said that quickening cannot, and by discovery of science, quickening cannot be any kind of line of demarcation. Perhaps we should submit to the ignorance and superstition that surrounded slavery in the same time period, Mr. Irving. Should we let the ignorant philosophies of the personhood of the African-American slaves guide us rather than what science and medicine reveal as objective truth? If Mr. Irving wants the superstition of quickening to determine the personhood of the unborn, why shouldn't we let the traditions of slavery and racism determine the personhood of ethnic groups? After all, slavery is as ancient a tradition as quickening, and there are plenty of pro-abortion articles that I have read that argue that abortion should be allowed because it is just as ancient in history as pregnancy. It is a tradition that has been around for thousands of years. Well, so has slavery. If we can champion the advances in science and philosophy to end the mistreatment of ethnic groups, why can't we be consistent and champion the advances in science and philosophy to end the mistreatment of the unborn, of all ethnic groups, Mr. Irving? To quote Mr. Irving from the article further, quote, "From the 1840s to 1900, we know the results of what the doctors did, not their thoughts," unquote. Once again, Mr. Irving hammers on this idea that we cannot know their thoughts. We know they got what they wanted, sweeping laws against abortion. Yes, agree. We just don't know their thoughts, according to Mr. Irving. None of the words they said matter. We can simply trust Mr. Irving and other abortion advocates that we have no idea why the doctors in the span of 60 years wanted to make abortion illegal. We can guess that they had some kind of sinister, self-serving reasons for this, because the real reasons cannot be what they actually wrote at length in articles and books. They just had to be covering up for themselves. Holy conspiracy theory, Batman! Now, for the remainder of the episode, I will give some history for our consideration. History that Mr. Irving either ignorantly or purposefully neglects. After all, we can't know his thoughts. So, our story begins in 1821. Before the 1840s, mind you, in this year, Connecticut, the state of Connecticut, passed a law to ban abortions after quickening. You mean it wasn't already illegal? Well, remember, courts would try people for murder, especially men, if their actions could be found to have caused the death of a child in the womb. Those who think anti-abortion laws were all about men in power, as the first episode of this series discussed at length, they should realize that the impetus was usually to protect women. The 1821 law in Connecticut criminalized the use of poisons to induce abortions after quickening, and the punishment was on the abortionist. Women were facing health complications from abortionists who prescribed the abortifacient remedies for their pregnancy hormonal issues. The legislation was intended to protect women from being exploited by harmful practices. As far as I can tell from my research, most pro-abortion historians would probably agree with this understanding of the 1821 law in Connecticut. So now, since this 1821 law, we shift a few decades later to the 1850s, and we will look at the life and efforts of a certain Dr. Horatio Robinson Storer, S-T-O-R-E-R. Dr. Storer was a native of Boston, Massachusetts. He graduated from Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and then from the Harvard Medical School in Boston. In 1853, he traveled to Europe and studied obstetrics at Edinburgh, Scotland, for 1 year. When he returned to Boston in 1855, he started practicing as an OBGYN doctor. Dr. Storer observed that a lot of medical practice that was looser on abortions prior to quickening and artificially treated quickening as a license to give women dangerous poisons or surgeries was really exploiting women for ideas that he realized were far out of date with current science. Dr. Storer is known for his what was called Physician's Crusade Against Abortion, which he began in 1857. Although he campaigned in Boston, he recognized that the problem of abortion was like an elephant in the room, and he wanted to persuade the medical profession throughout the nation to consider the issue the way he understood. The American Medical Association, you may have heard of this, the American Medical Association, or AMA, was a new and voluntary association of medical doctors forming around this time, and Dr. Storer pleaded his case to them as a policy for doctors to promote integrity in the medical profession. He convinced the young AMA to establish a, quote, what they called a Committee on Criminal Abortion. The report of this was finalized on April 25, 1857. In this report, the AMA makes the following observation about abortions and quickening. Quote, common as the crime, referring to abortion, common as the crime may be in an advanced stage after the existence of pregnancy has been made certain by its more evident signs, it is infinitely more common in the early months before motion has occurred. When so many ignorantly believe that the child has therefore not yet received life, unquote. This is on pages 3-4 of the report. In other words, the medical profession through this report, rather than allowing for blissful ignorance, understood when human life began. The facts of medical discovery revealed that the current culture needed to be informed about what was really happening. The outdated concept of quickening as an indicator for pregnancy did not fit the facts. Even at this time, many abortion practitioners were not even regarding quickening as a barrier to abortions. Without reporting their practices and keeping these things hush-hush, abortions were becoming more commonplace at later stages. Because statistics were difficult to gather because of underreporting, the report observed 15 documented cases of abortions and, quote, all without exception were married and respectable women, unquote. This is from page 4 of the report. In other words, abortions were not merely for desperate women who were poor or who were raped or exploited. It was just as common, if not more common, for well-to-do, married, upper-class women to get abortions simply out of convenience and luxury. The report argued, quote, there can be no possible excuse for the induction of abortion, either in the earlier or later months of pregnancy, except to save the life of the mother or of the fetus within her womb, and so should the law premise, unquote. Why would the report argue this way? Perhaps consistency? Perhaps since medical science proves that life begins at conception? To be consistent, if murder is the taking of a human life and abortion is the taking of a human life, then abortion is clearly an act of murder. So, in examining the statutes in Massachusetts at the time that criminalized abortifacient practices only if the mother's health were harmed, the report stated, quote, the law is here fundamentally wrong. It utterly ignores the existence of the living child. though the child is really alive from the moment of its conception, and from that very moment is and should be considered a distinct being. This the law does not, however, recognize, unquote. Isn't that what a lot of the abortion debate is about today? Well, at this time, the policy was going from ignorance to proven science. In contradistinction, I would say that today the policy seemed to want to go from proven science back to philosophies about personhood and viability and other such nebulous terms. The pro-abortion rhetoric has moved from, quote, a clump of cells, unquote, to accept the fact that human life does begin at conception, because science proves that. But it seems that science and consistency is not enough to convince the pro-abortion lobby of the error of their ways. They begin with the assumption that abortion must be a right, and no amount of science is acceptable to deny that. The pro-abortion arguments now have become philosophy, and science seems to be the proper domain of the pro-life position. So now let's reconsider the conspiracy theory of Mr. Irving and other abortion advocates about doctors. It is not too much hyperbole, I would suggest, that Dr. Horatio Storr was virtually single-handedly influential in convincing the young American Medical Association to campaign for stricter abortion laws that recognize that the unborn themselves were full human lives and should have the protection as such. What may seem to aid this idea of conspiracy actually does not. Remember, the AMA was very young at this time and not a large political force. It did not have the power yet of political maneuvering with deep pockets and contributions to the campaigns of political candidates. That is not how the AMA campaigned. They simply presented the cold, hard reality. And state legislatures naturally recognized that the laws needed to be updated to align with science and morality. So let's explore some of this science and morality from Dr. Storr's writings. In 1866, Dr. Storr wrote a short book entitled, Why Not? A Book for Every Woman. Mr. Irving's accusations against the doctors in their medical profession being selfish are actually addressed in this book. You know, the kind of accusations that Mr. Irving makes in his article. So let's look at a quote from this book by Dr. Storr. Quote, "There are those, perhaps, who may suppose that in advising that pregnancies once begun should be allowed to go on their full period, physicians are actuated by a selfish motive," unquote. This is from page 12. Storr argues that the book goes on to demonstrate that the evidence proves that forced abortions are actually more dangerous to the mothers in the process and in the effects on their health later on in their lives than if they naturally delivered full term. Storr, in his introduction, continues to reason that, quote, "Would women listen to the appeal now to be made them, an immense deal of ill health would be prevented, and thousands of maternal as well as fetal lives would annually be saved," unquote, page 13. Imagine that. You mean the way nature works is, on average, naturally preferable to invasive procedures that both kill a child in the womb and interrupt the hormonal processes of the mother and risk potential ill effects? Perish that thought. Storr continues, quote, "To women, on the other hand, how interesting the topic. It is one that affects, and more directly perhaps than anyone else can, their health, their lives," quote. Yeah, Mr. Irving, we don't know their thoughts, right? Continuing on, quote, "For cases of insanity in women from the physical shock of an induced abortion or from subsequent remorse are not uncommon," unquote. Yup, all made up, right? What an imagination Dr. Storr has to speak for women. Even then, abortion procedures were less clean as they are today. Yet, there exists plenty of resources that show regret after abortion. For more information about abortion regret with testimonies and help, see the Silent No More Awareness campaign at www.silentnomoreawareness.org. And of course, abortion advocates try to claim that these testimonies are statistically insignificant and overblown, yet these testimonies demonstrate that much regret is not reported, because the tendency of dealing with regret is first to deny it, to bottle it, to shelve it, to fight against it, and sometimes become callous to it, but it's still there. Suppressed in the subconsciousness only to eat away at the health of these women and their souls. And just as abortions in the 1800s were underreported and miscategorized, so cases of abortion regret can obviously be underreported and miscategorized. So let's continue on with some more quotes from Dr. Storr's book. Storr begins chapter 2 of his book by stating, quote, "In our appeal, we shall endeavor to go straight towards the mark, nothing concealing, undervaluing, or selfishly excusing," unquote, page 15. So, you mean he actually presented his case straightforwardly, or at least he thought he did? He expected his case to be open to scrutiny and proof? If his arguments were really concealing a sinister and selfish motivation for doctors and their practice, why would he be able to craft such arguments that seem to be so persuasive and so testable in science, philosophy, morality, and legality? Storr admits, quote, "From time immemorial, such have been the deplorable tendencies of unbridled desire, of selfishness and extravagance, of an absence of true conjugal affection. There has existed in countless human breasts a wanton disregard for fetal life, a practical approval of infanticide," unquote, page 16. So one may ask, doesn't the fact that abortive practices have been common throughout history demonstrate that it's just a part of civilization and therefore need to be allowed by law? Well, as I mentioned earlier, wouldn't the fact that the practices of abusive slavery, adultery, and murder have been around since time immemorial prove the same, that they are all a part of civilization and that therefore the law should protect these activities? So ponder this for a moment. Shouldn't we allow discoveries in science and the development of ethics to expose to us that practices rooted in ignorance and barbarism are harmful and immoral? The argument from historical precedents obviously does not an argument make. Now, I believe in absolute truth and would not identify in any way with the term progressive. Yet, shouldn't even a so-called progressive position understand that policies should change as things advance over time? Why wouldn't policies dealing with abortion change with the advancement of science? Let's not forget that Mr. Irving likes the idea of quickening as a better test for personhood. On page 82 of the book, Storr actually addresses an accusation against the medical doctors for selfish monetary gain or of practicing abortions themselves. Storr responds that any within the association who did so were dismissed with shame. he demonstrates that upholding the ancient Hippocratic oath that swears not to intend miscarriages is key to this policy in the association. You mean the doctors were not acting out of selfish motives? Well, I guess if we were like Mr. Irving, we could assume that even this admission could just be covering up their true intentions, but, you know, maybe we should actually take Dr. Storr's words at face value. I mean, doesn't this reflect his intentions? In chapter 3 of the book, Storr begins to make the case that intentional abortion is more than simply a matter of, quote, abstract morality and religion, unquote, page 27. What? You mean science is also involved? It's not just purely an issue of superstition and incantations involving charms and candles and rituals, as we might think of religion being. Storr clearly states, quote, "Physicians have now arrived at the unanimous opinion that the fetus in utero is alive from the very moment of conception," unquote. Now, if Mr. Irving wants to dispute this claim, I would invite him to show the science against this statement. Is such a claim a conspiracy of medical professionals to serve a selfish agenda? Remember, this statement, a scientific claim, challenges the quickening doctrine, which survived originally only on anecdotal evidence that has now been proven wrong. And this anecdotal evidence lacked the scientific advancements. Storr continues on pages 32 to 33 of the book to explain that some view quickening as the start of life, and others that breath is, you know, when they take the baby takes the first breath from birth. But Storr argues that neither of these ignorant ideas can be facts. According to Storr, not every mother experiences this quickening feeling, and physicians could hear the operations of the fetus's heart and lungs while inside. You know, scientific discovery. On page 34, Storr asks this poignant question that is very commonly asked of abortion advocates today, quote, "In what does this life really differ from that of the child 5 minutes into the world? Is not then forced abortion a crime?" Unquote. But why should we accept such a logical question consistent with medical facts when we can simply assume that the question is really a cover for dominating women and controlling reproductive rights? You know, why should we let science influence our philosophies? So, Storr then proceeds to explain that not only is abortion a crime against the child in the womb, but also that it poses a greater risk to the mother's health and life than the natural process of full term and birth. After arguing that more women die from abortion than birth, experience physically handicapping consequences or risk serious diseases later in life, Storr defends them against accusations of potential ulterior motives. This is pages 36 through 37. Storr then elaborates why these observations are the case. Science shows that women's bodies progress during pregnancy and prepare naturally for the usual term of 9 months, and when the fetus of the womb is ripped away from the body's natural expectations, health complications can be immediate or even realized years later. This information comes from pages 37 through 38. Now, consider the fact that abortion procedures in the mid-1800s were less, shall we say, perfected and sterile than they are now. How much more would we understand Storr to be honest when he talks about risks of health and life to the mother? Does this really sound like a cover for desiring to control so-called reproductive rights? What makes more sense to you? Storr even continues to make the case that abortions can also affect fertility and the potential health of future children that a mother may wish to have later after she's had an abortion. Pages 49 through 50 cover this. Another issue that Storr brings up is that intentional abortions can often leave remnants of fetal tissue that can cause infections that can lead to death. Pages 54 through 55. Yes, indeed. It sounds as if Dr. Storr wants to dominate women and deny them their reproductive rights. Now, before I belabor all the points and information Storr makes in this book aimed at caring both for women and their unborn children, I want to skip down to a small section on pages 84 through 85. Pro-abortion advocates love to make an example of Dr. Storr in this section because it is known for an oft-quoted statement that understandably reminds leftists of the way they believe President Donald Trump thinks. In speaking of the expansion of open lands primarily to the West, Storr said, quote, shall they be filled by our own children or by those of aliens? This is a question that our own women must answer. Upon their loins depends the future destiny of the nation, unquote. Now, without a proper context, one can be led to believe that Storr's motivation for fighting abortion was to ensure that white people could take over the open lands before other inferior races do. When pro-abortionists assume malicious motivations of anti-abortionists, because they can't allow the actual issue of what is the unborn to stand, they seem to find boogeymen that aren't really there. First, Storr's ill-quoted statement is an extremely brief and inconsequential part of a book that is otherwise entirely about the science and conclusive morality related to intentional abortion as killing a human life and harming the mother emotionally, physically, and morally. Second, the context has nothing to do with race or white people. Storr laments the large losses of life due to war, quote-unquote, war, quote-unquote, and to, quote, disease and the sword, unquote. He speaks about the, quote, destiny of the nation, unquote, and that new homes would best be inhabited by, quote, free men, unquote. So basically, in context, Storr was suggesting that the West neighboring land was open for civilization that would best be for citizens of America and the freedoms we enjoy. If Americans were overly focused on the crime of abortion for convenience, we would essentially be wait too long and allow some other nation to take advantage of the open lands and colonize them. Storr's statement has zero to do with whiteness or race. It has to do with the self-destruction of a nation intent on killing its own, while those of other nations could inhabit the land right next to us. If Storr can be accused of having some sense of pride in the well-being of his own nation, why is that such a bad thing? It has been difficult for me to find good information about the Honorable Dr. Storr on the internet from abortion advocates that are more than simply regurgitating the quote I explained. However, one site did try to give him some credit, but was puzzled about why he would actually be against abortions. This site is thesexualityandsocialmedia.wordpress.com, And the article is entitled Dr. Horatio R. Storr, 1830 to 1922. That's the range of his life. So to quote the article, quote, Dr. Storr is the founder of modern gynecology practice and was a pioneer in the great physician's crusade against abortion in the 1850s. It is unclear as to why Storr was so against the abortion practice. Like many of his time, it could have been religiously related. It could have also been his great concern and love for the female anatomy. As the author of various informative books on women and women's health, he was a man of great curiosity and attempted to educate people in the particular study, unquote. So, it is unclear as to why Storr was so against the abortion practice? Once again, if abortion advocates would simply read the words, they would know better. If the author of this brief article would have read the book I just read through and gave some salient highlights from, the author would have a very clear understanding of why Storr argued against abortion. Storr argued his case in spades. And that is all the time that we have for this episode. Please stay tuned for the next episode of Truthspresso, where we bring this critique of John Irving's article to a conclusion.
Thank you for waking up with Truthspresso. Good morning, and God bless your day.
Hey friends, Daniel Minnick here again. If you liked waking up to this episode of Truthspresso, I would really appreciate it if you would rate it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever application you use to listen to Truthspresso.